I'm coming to you from Washington, D.C. at the ITRC headquarters. I will serve as your moderator for today. I will cover just a few points before we start and also let you know how you can actively participate. This training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document noted on this slide. LNAPL Site Management, LCSM, Evolution, Decision Process, and Remedial Technologies. This guidance document was produced by ITRC in 2018, and although we will be able to share a lot of information with you today, we certainly will not be able to share all the tools and resources available in this guidance document. So we strongly encourage you to take a look at it if you haven't already done so. We hope it will serve as a resource for you as you are working on your environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Today's training is scheduled for about 2 hours and 15 minutes. We are also recording this event to make it available on demand for those who are not able to make it today. Trainers will be in control of the slides as we move through today's training session. If you'd like to control your own slides, you are able to download the slides from the initial training page you were directed to today. You can also access the slides by going to the related link section, clicking on the CLUIN training page, and then clicking Browse To. We want to hear from everybody today, both your questions and your feedback. You'll have an opportunity about halfway through for a question and answer break, as well as at the end. But at any time today, you can feel free to ask your questions in the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. We will try to answer as many of those questions as we can verbally during the question and answer break. If we have too many questions to answer out loud, we will ask our trainers to respond directly back to that person in writing through our Adobe Connect website. For those of you on the phone line, if you would like to ask a question out loud, we will also give you an opportunity to ask your questions during the Q&A break. And we will remind you at that time that it is #6 to unmute. There is also an online feedback form for you to complete to let us know how the training went today. By completing this feedback form, you will be eligible to receive your certificate of completion to support your documentation of continuing education. At the end of the feedback form, you will be able to certify that you participated today. Once you do that, a certificate will be issued to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, training, resources, and training courses such as the one you are participating on today. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the ITRC website or feel free to contact me directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can be an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you do plan to use ITRC materials, we do ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material or endorse any specific products. On slide number 5, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our expert trainers. All of them have been active members of ITRC's LNAPL team over the years. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they have dedicated many hours to develop this guidance document. A special thank you to all of them for participating today. Our trainers today are Randy Chapman from Virginia Department of Environmental Quality, Natasha Cejota from Chevron Energy, and Sanjay Garg from Shell Global Solutions. If you'd like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios at the link at the bottom of the page. You can also access it in the related link section by clicking on CLUIN training page and then clicking Browse To. At the bottom of the training page, you can access their bios as well. So with that said, let's move on to the next slide, and I will pass it off to Randy.
Thank you, Tadbir. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the first internet-based training for the new decade in 2020. And it looks like we have a broad audience looking at the sign-up sheet where everybody's from. But here, as Tadbir indicated, it's the first part of a three-part webinar session, part one, and this is about LNAPL. So we're going to talk about, you know, what is it, and today we're going to cover the fundamentals. But first of all, what is LNAPL? When we talk about LNAPL, we're talking about light, non-aqueous phase liquids. So what's so special about it? Why do we care about it? Well, because LNAPL itself may have concerns that are above and beyond just, let's say, if it's just simple soil contamination or simple some dissolve phase. LNAPL can create issues with vapor inside of structures, inside of utilities. It can create issues with migration. It can be aesthetic issues. It can be simply political issues that you cannot leave LNAPL behind because maybe your regulatory requirements don't allow you to leave any LNAPL. It can create a long-term source for your dissolved phase contamination, particularly if you have receptors nearby or impacted wells or streams or other receptors that are at risk. So it can have certainly unique characteristics that go beyond just, you know, maybe a small amount of soil or a small amount of dissolved phase. So it has its own unique concerns. So one of the things that we're going to talk about today, and Sanjay and Natasha are going to be going through are the concepts and the issues and that's that are associated with LNAPL. The next bullet there, you see, it's difficult to assess. And I will tell you, with all my years here, and what we can tell you is, just because you put a hole in the ground, just because you put a well or monitoring point, and you don't see LNAPL present, doesn't mean that it is not there. It is there. And probably in one form or another, but it can be difficult to assess and determine the extent and severity. So we're going to go through a lot of the fundamentals today to help you understand that. And what we're going to hopefully that you get from this presentation is that you're using the science, that you're going to use everything you're learning today and over the next 2 weeks to help you look at your site and accurately assess your situation if you have LNAPL present and it's one of those concerns that you have to deal with. All right. So next slide here. All right, just really kind of a quick overview. That's what my role here is today. We're very fortunate that ITRC has been dealing with LNAPL for as a guidance issue and training issue for many years. And we've seen it used, the guidance and the training and the information provided all over the country. It's because everything is shaded blue on the map here, but also the states that have the little stacks of paper, that's basically states that have in some way, shape, or form, adopted ITRC guidance, LNAPL guidance, into their policies or programs or guidance documents. So this map probably needs to be updated because more states have done this. But we've had a great effect, and we're hoping to be able to continue that as we move forward. Now, specifically for me, how I got involved, well, I first got involved with this LNAPL issue here in my state of Virginia, and we developed closure evaluation for sites for free product. And you'll see this, you make free product or LNAPL used interchangeably. And what we did back in here in Virginia, back in 2012, we created and developed a guidance that allows for LNAPL to be remaining at site and getting to case closure after you address all the risk issues. Now that's unique for Virginia. Every state, every organization is going to have their own, mindset and what they can do and can't do based upon their statutory requirements or their regulatory requirements. That's how I got involved originally with this program. Also, the Colorado has done it. The original Eric Gessert from Colorado and I were the team leads for this last iteration of the update. Now, a little history for those of you who are not familiar. As I noted, we've been doing ITRC. Has been involved with ITRC or with LNAPL guidance for a long time, started back in the 2000s where ITRC developed and released the LNAPL 1 and LNAPL 2 documents that talked about natural source zone depletion and evaluating LNAPL remedial technologies. We immediately went into classroom training and online training, and we have trained thousands of people over the years, and it's been personally, I think, very successful. And as but we realized after a number of years that we needed to update some of the information, update how we were doing it, because we were finding that some of the online training was going above and beyond what we had discussed in the original guidance. So in the 2016, we put together the team again. The band got back together and updated the guidance. And in March of 2018, we released LNAPL 3, which is the site management. And you'll see the LNAPL conceptual site model evolution, decision process, remedial technologies. And 2 years ago, we had our first of the new online training. which is what you're attending here today. Now, as Tadbir said at the very beginning, you're not going to learn everything you need to know here today. We recognize that. So our webpage for ITRC has a lot of that information, a lot of the guidance, and the background stuff, and we certainly would strongly suggest that you go there to download the information and to review the information, because it's a lot more than what we can cover in these webinars. But for this LNAPL 3 document, what we did was we expanded on the key concepts, which we're going to get to in a few minutes. We really talked about how we developed the conceptual site model specifically for LNAPL. Personal note, I think this is one of the things as a state regulator that we have not done a very good job on over the decades of understanding the site. And by having a better grasp of what's going on, having a better conceptual site model, personally, I believe that you'll see that you have a better, you'll do a better decision making on how to address the LNAPL and, you know, to understand the risk and everything associated with it. So we're going to talk a lot more about that. We're going to emphasize using SMART objectives. Truth is, if we had $1 billion for every site and 1 billion years, we could clean up everything down to zero. We don't. So we're talking about using specific, measurable, achievable, that's a big word there, realistic and timely. Are the goals and objectives that we're setting, can we actually get there? And that's what we are going to talk about here is, can we really get to where we need to be with our, you know, our game plan? What's laid out is, can we actually achieve what we want to? And that's where we talk about the SMART objectives. The guidance also expands on the value of LNAPL transmissivity and natural source zone depletion as a strategy to address LNAPL present at your site. All right. Now, who should use this document? When I say this, everybody, I mean it. If I look at the sign-up sheet here, we have people from consultants, state agencies, stakeholders, a variety of people, any person that may be involved with LNAPL at the site. Personally think there's the more people who understand the science, who understand what's there and the issues it creates, we're going to come to a better resolution. ITRC operates on a consensus strategy, and that should be no different than when we're dealing in the real world, when we're dealing with the regulated community, the local citizens groups, state governments, local governments, stakeholders, concerns, anybody who's been involved. It needs to be consensus, and to get there, we all have to understand what we're looking at. So I think this is a useful document for everybody to use, not just your state regulator or your federal regulator or your, you know, high-level consultant. Anybody who's dealing with LNAPL can get value from these documents, from this document. Now, for a lot of you, maybe you've never had really exposure to an LNAPL site, and probably most of you, I'm going to guess here that if you run into it, it's been small, it's been isolated, it's not really a huge plume. It doesn't matter. The science, the underlying science is the same. So the things that would apply on a small, let's say, you know, 50-gallon release of LNAPL is the same thing that's going to apply to 50,000 or 500,000 or even larger. I mean, the understanding, the science is what's going to help you resolve your issue, but it's all the same regardless of the size. So this applies to all the sites that you're going to deal with, not just the big, you know, pipeline sites or refinery sites or any, you know, these huge industrial. This will apply across the board no matter what type of site, from large to small. Here in Virginia, we do everything from home heating oil cases to the big terminals. This information applies to all of them. Now, again, it's going to be everything, mom and pops to the bulk terminals. All right, the science is the same. Now, to the learning objectives over the next 3 weeks, today we're just going to focus on using the LNAPL science to your advantage to apply this site. So everything that we do today is the science. Next week, we're going to go into the developing the conceptual site model and how to talk about stakeholders and getting them involved in the decision-making process. And the third week will be about selecting the remedial technologies to achieve your desired objectives. Prepare a transition between LNAPL strategies. Real quickly on this one, this is, again, something I don't think as a regulatory agency or as a community. We've done a really good job. There's not one magic bullet for all sites. Our history has shown us that a lot of times we will transition from one strategy, one approach as we move through a case. And I think over the years we have done a really good job of how that transition occurs and what method it will occur, and to have everybody understand that this is just part of the process. So transitioning between strategies or technologies is something we're going to be discussing, and again, getting to the SMART, the specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and timely. All right. Last one, again, part one, connecting the science to LNAPL site management, what we're going to talk about today. Now, what you'll see also is that a lot of this connects to the guidance document that we're going to be talking about. And this is what this slide here is. Today, we're just going to be going over part one. You know, this is covered in section three of your guidance document. You'll see this figure a lot in the document. As you can see, it's color-coded, so it will help you determine and give you a kind of a clue as to what sections of the guidance document you'll find information on. You know, it's three and four, or five, and the sections as we move through. But this is, you know, there's flow charts, there's charts, there's graph and things like that within this document, and that to help you go along. But right now, today, we're just going to focus on the science. And so I'm going to turn it over to Sanjay, and he's going to start with the key concepts, and I will be back near the end of the webinar to kind of wrap things up. So Sanjay, it's all yours.
All right. Thanks, Randy. My name is Sanjay Garg, and I and Natasha Sihota from Chevron will carry you through for, I guess, next hour and a half or so through the technical messages and the way we have laid it out. The rest of the slides are laid out. There are key messages that we'll go through, and I'll go through them now on the next couple of slides, and then on each key message, then we'll kind of explain the science behind it through the presentation, and Natasha and I will alternate so that you don't get bored with one of our voices. So some of the key messages that you'll hear today is that if you see LNAPL in wells, it doesn't mean that the formation is 100% saturated with LNAPL. Or as Randy was mentioning earlier, that LNAPL can be present in the formation in the subsurface, even though it doesn't show up in wells. And if so, how can you tell there is LNAPL? As you go through today's IBT internet-based training and sessions two and three, you'll hear this concept of composition of LNAPL versus saturation of LNAPL. So we'll try to make a differentiation between those two. And then there is a lot of lack of clarity, misunderstanding around how to interpret the thickness of LNAPL in a well, and how does it really change? Why does it change? So we'll talk about that. And so that's four and five. Then we'll also talk about a lot of times when you see LNAPL in a monitoring well, the general perception is that it must be moving. So it'll help you understand when it's moving, when it's not moving, how to really tell whether LNAPL's moving or it's just sitting there. If looks like many of you are practitioners, probably have already heard the term transmissivity, this concept of LNAPL transmissivity. So we'll kind of introduce it today a little bit, and there's a whole lot more in internet-based training two in a week from today. Then some kind of specific cases, Clean Water Act, you see sheens in the water, and it drives certain regulations, certain public perception, et cetera. So we'll go over why do you see sheens in water. And then finally, these biological processes, we've always known them, but it's got a little bit of a new life as our understanding improves. So we'll kind of introduce this concept of natural source zone depletion towards the end of it. So going through the first key message is, as I had introduced earlier, that when you see an apple in a well, it doesn't mean that the formation is fully saturated with NAPL. The NAPL and water share pore space. That's the key home take-home message from the next few slides here. So to start, build that concept, let's just kind of see how an NAPL body develops, or how a release from a tank kind of manifests itself in the formation, right? So these are four timestamps, time 1, 2, 3, 4 in that sequence. You've got an underground storage tank in this picture that's leaking. And as the oil is leaking, the NAPL is leaking, it kind of reaches the water table. It'll come down with gravity, and it starts mounding on that water, groundwater, because the pores are fully saturated with water. So there is no place for this oil to go. At some point, there's enough oil that builds up that breaks that resistance, overcomes that resistance from the groundwater, and penetrates below the water table. And the colors that you see here are basically just saying how much NAPL is there, and the terminology or the term for that is saturation, basically saying how much of the pore space is filled with NAPL, right? And high doesn't mean 100% high, just is some number, usually 30-40% is high on some soils. And by the time you get to time 3, the release has stopped, and I'm on slide 19, people who are following on their own and not following on the screen. So we're on slide 19. So by the time the release has stopped, when you're on time 3, the oil, NAPL is lighter than water, there's buoyancy that's pushing it up, right? So initially, goes down at a high saturation, and then it starts to come up, and that's where you see some of these yellow bands forming. And at some point, this body reaches some sort of an equilibrium. The terminology that you'll see in the literature is vertical equilibrium. Just think about like an ice cube. You push it down, and it bounces up, and you remove that pressure from your finger, and then it kind of bounces and reaches that stable condition. That's the vertical equilibrium of this oil. And this is idealized case, but that's what you'll generally see, that there's a low saturation below the high saturation area, and there's a vertical distribution of saturation. Some places it's high, some places it's low. This is idealized. In kind of upcoming slides, you'll see what real life looks like, but it helps us conceptualize. And in this particular slide, if you put in this particular example, if you were to put a monitoring well right in the core of that release, that well shows where you would see a NAPL. So this is what you'll see in the well, and above and below that you have some smear zone, quote-unquote smear zone, where the NAPL is present. Same concept as previous slide. Now I'm on slide 20 now. This is a tank experiment. Think about 2-3 inch deep, like deep in the plane perpendicular to your screen or your paper. Tank a few feet down, and then several feet left to right. And there's a release that was kind of oil that was dyed, and a release that was simulated. And initially you see that LNAPL kind of percolates down, like in the previous picture, goes below this water table. And once that release has depleted, that LNAPL kind of bounces up. It's hard to see, but you could see some color difference between the figure on the left and figure on the right, kind of showing that on the previous slide, what we had green and yellow as lower saturation. So there's some lower saturation area that's below the water table. Kind of same concept, another slide. This is done in a, again, in a lab tank, in a fish tank, essentially. And what you see on the figure on the right is, to the left of it is a PVC slotted screen that was cut in half and kind of glued to the screen, to the face of the tank. And the tank has some oil that was dyed with fluorescent material, and the picture's taken fluorescent light. So the yellow in the screen on the left-hand side picture that you see in the monitoring well, quote-unquote monitoring well, is what you see in the screen. And then when you look to the right of it, that's the formation, and you could see that the El Napal is kind of distributed. There's higher amount, higher saturation towards the top of that, and then as you go deeper, there's less Napal, and there is some Napal even below the interval where the bottom of the oil is in the monitoring well. So again, take-home message is the formation is not 100% filled with oil or with Napal. Now I'm on slide 22. So the traditional conceptualizations of El Napal have been that El Napal floats on the water table, and once you put in a monitoring well, it kind of just percolates in, and you see that exaggeration. If you see some of the older literature, some of the even older regulations, there is this rule of thumb that people had used to use that it's exaggerated by a factor of 10, factor of 4, and et cetera. So now, with all the science that's been there in the last 25, 30 years, even older, we kind of all accept that that's a flawed conceptual model. The other conceptual model which kind of comes to people's mind is, I have got Napal in the well, my formation must be fully saturated with oil in that interval. That kind of comes from that extrapolation that people have from groundwater wells, right? So if you have groundwater in a well or water in a well, then it's reasonable to believe that the formation is fully saturated with water, right? That's our traditional thinking. That's our traditional science. Hydrogeology tells us that. But reality is, because water was already there, Napal has to share that pore space. It has to push some of the water out, and the picture on the far right actually is what formation looks like. The Napal is able to displace some water, and because it's able to displace some water, both oil and water enter the monitoring well. Oil is lighter than water, so it floats on top. And with this, I will hand over to Dr. Natasha Sihura from Chevron to continue with the key message too. Natasha?
Thanks, Sanjay. So in this section, we'll be building on the material that Sanjay talked about and looking at Napal behavior when we're seeing it in the formation, even if it's not accumulating in a well. So moving on to slide 24, Napal can be present in the formation even if we're not seeing that Napal flow into our monitoring wells. And in this section, we'll talk a little bit about how we can identify that there is Napal present, some measurements that we can take, and helping to develop that conceptual model of where we may or may not have Napal present in the formation, regardless of whether it's flowing into our monitoring wells. Slide 25, for those of you following along. So first of all, we need to be thinking about the composition of Napal. And really, we have Napal that can be present across a large range of concentrations. It can be present at residual concentration or residual saturation, where it's not able to flow into the wells, but it's still present in the formation. And then as we go to higher and higher saturations of Napal, it can be mobile or potentially migrating, which we'll talk about later on in the course. Under those conditions, we could have Napal flowing into our wells. Across that whole range of Napal saturation, we do have potential compositional concerns related to our contaminants of concern. And then it's really only when we have those higher saturations of Napal where we have the potential concerns related to mobility and migration. But it really is all Napal, so depending on how much of it is present is going to dictate whether or not we have concerns about the mobility, but it's all Napal. On the next slide, we'll look at an example where we have a Napal vertical extent that is greater than what we're seeing in our thicknesses in wells. So on this cross-section, we have our water table sloping down from the left hand of the slide to the right hand of the slide. And we have our monitoring wells sectioned across the site. We see in two monitoring wells that we do have NAPL present here. We have NAPL present in our monitoring well and the further down gradient monitoring well. But we also have NAPL present in the formation in a larger area than what we would assume if we were just looking at our monitoring well data. So this is something really key to be aware of, that we have this NAPL present that can be feeding our groundwater plume, which we'll talk about on the next slide. So on slide 27 now, this is a key way to identify if we have NAPL present in the formation, and that is that if we have a persistent groundwater plume, there may be a NAPL source that's feeding that groundwater plume. So even though that NAPL may not flow into the well, if we have high concentrations of our dissolved phase contaminants of concern, that can indicate that we have NAPL present in the formation. So here to illustrate that example, we have this NAPL present on the left-hand side of this groundwater plume, and then the groundwater that's in close contact to the NAPL has high concentrations of our dissolved phase constituents, and those dissolved phase constituents decrease in concentration as we're moving away from this NAPL source. So to get a little bit more quantitative about how we can identify if we have NAPL present in the formation that's feeding our groundwater plume, we can look at the effective solubility of different chemicals in the mixture. So using Raoult's law, we can look at our different chemicals of concern. So here in this table, for example, we have benzene, toluene, and xylene, and looking at the concentration of those chemicals in our NAPL mixture. So here, for example, looking at either a gasoline or a diesel, and then we know the pure phase solubility of those chemicals. And so then using the mole fraction and the pure phase solubility, we can calculate an effective solubility of that particular chemical in the particular LNAPL mixture, and that can guide us in identifying if we have a NAPL mixture feeding a groundwater plume. So if we have the concentrations approaching the effective solubility of our different chemicals, then that's an indication that we have a NAPL that is feeding that dissolved phase. Here on slide 29 is an illustration of the concept that I was just mentioning. So we have our groundwater concentrations moving from left to right. We are increasing in our groundwater concentration of our chemical of concern in relation to the effective solubility of that chemical. And as we approach the effective solubility, we have an increased likelihood that we have NAPL present in the formation, as I mentioned, feeding that groundwater plume. So what about soil? Well, we can do something similar to what we were looking at in our groundwater. So here we're looking at CSAT values, and now we're thinking about TPH, or total petroleum hydrocarbon, our measured value of hydrocarbon in the soil. And we need to remember that that's a measurement of the hydrocarbon in the soil gas, the pore water, the sorbed phase, and the NAPL. So using our CSAT values, we can identify a concentration where that space is saturated with hydrocarbons. So if our TPH measurement from our soil is greater than our CSAT value, there's another good indication that you have NAPL present. And this is going to vary again with the NAPL type. So on the table here, we're looking at a gasoline or a middle distillate. And then now we have to look also at the media. So we're going to have different CSAT values for different types of sediment. As you'd expect, it goes along with our grain size. We have some variation there in how much the different types of media can hold in terms of the hydrocarbon concentration for our CSAT values. And here's just an example on the right-hand side of our CSAT in terms of milligrams for kilogram of TPH. There's a reference here for anyone who's interested to dive into this in a little more detail. So there are a couple of cautions that we need to consider when we're looking at TPH. We do not want to collect soil samples at predetermined intervals, so we want to make sure that we are using our field screening techniques to identify where we can collect soil samples that will provide us useful data. We want to, of course, ensure that the TPH range that we're looking at is representative of the NAPL type. So thinking if we have a diesel spill, we don't want to use TPHG. Similarly, if we have a crude oil release, we need to be looking at something that will capture that wide range of carbon chains. So we need to be looking at perhaps an oil and grease method or another longer chain evaluation. And lastly here, we don't want to stop at the water table. We want to make sure that we capture the hydrocarbons that are potentially trapped in the smear zone. So we want to get down to a clean value so that we can fully identify the extent of the hydrocarbons at our site. All right, now moving on to slide 32, for those of you following along separately, we'll look at an example of how we can use this information. So on the left-hand side, we have an image of our site. Groundwater flow is moving from the top left of the diagram to the bottom right. And we have a number of monitoring wells across the site where we have historic concentrations of benzene. And then we also have some soil TPH concentrations from our boring logs here. So if we look back at our concentrations of gasoline and concentration of benzene in relation to the solubility concentration in gasoline, we can see that we have a few locations where we may indicate that NAPL is present. So that's referring back to slide 28. Similarly, if we look at the CSAT TPH values, referring back to slide 30, we can identify that there are a few areas from our soil boring logs where we have exceedances of the CSAT for TPH. And here's our groundwater plume. And then using that data, we can look at the monitoring wells where we have NAPL present. Moving on to the next slide, we see a cross-section of our site where we have NAPL both in our monitoring wells, here in monitoring well 2, 3, and 1, and then also in the formation associated with those higher TPH values that we saw in the last slide. And so just to drive home that we can have situations, or we often have situations, where we have NAPL present in the formation, but it's not flowing into our monitoring wells, and it may be held at residual saturation in the formation, potentially still causing an important source for our groundwater plumes. So now we're going to move on and talk briefly about a couple of measurement techniques that we can use to identify our LNAPL in the field. So starting on slide 34, it's really important to use all of the field measurements that we can to get the most useful information out of our site work. Of course, the boring logs are very important to understand the lithology, potentially looking at any stains or odors, and then using field-based measurements such as the oleophilic dyes and shaker jars, there's a picture there on the bottom left, to identify TPH. Now this is going to, of course, be a relatively coarse measurement, but those can be quite useful in the field. On the next slide, we have another example of a type of NAPL measurement that can be used. In this case, we're looking at a fluorescence-based measurement. Important to note here is that all fluorescence may not be NAPL. There are different types of materials that can fluoresce, such as antifreeze and detergents. And similarly, not all NAPLs are going to fluoresce. So for example, a heavy crude won't fluoresce in the same way as a refined product. So we need to be aware of the limitations associated with the different hydrocarbon types. And lastly, one important method that we have for the lab side is looking at pore fluid saturations. Here we're showing a picture of a Dean Stark extraction, and this can help us identify if we have NAFL present at residual saturation or at greater than residual saturation, which will be important for site characterization in terms of identifying if we have the potential for a mobile or migrating NAFL. And with that, I'll hand it back to Sanjay to talk about key message 3.
All right, so we will talk about saturation versus composition and which lever to turn depending on what you want to achieve. So very quickly, you heard Natasha talk about Raoult's Law, so I'll go over it quickly. Basically, Raoult's Law just says that the solubility of any given chemical from a mixture is proportional to the amount of how much that individual chemical is in that mixture, right? So if you've got gasoline, gasoline's got hundreds of chemicals, and that chemical by itself may have a certain solubility, but when you actually work with gasoline, the solubility that it'll have in water is proportional to its mole fraction in the mixture. And what I'd like you to look at and focus on this slide is that one equation, and this is slide 38, one equation that's kind of in the blue, right? It says effective solubility equals mole fraction times pure component solubility. And just think about, there is no term for the amount of NAPL in that equation. Right? It's basically just saying, it's proportional to what the composition is, not how much it is. So with that in mind, you could actually try to think about your strategy on where to adjust the saturation, on what cases saturation change makes more sense versus where does it make sense to change the composition, right? So to do that, this is a very idealized case. It's in your, like the guide, book also is explained there, so I'll try to go through it quickly. Think of a case, base case, no remediation. This whole gray area is impacted, and you've got a monitoring well that's just screened through that interval. And if you didn't do anything and it was just soil washing, so we're ignoring biodegradation in this case, it's just water going from left to right, it'll take some time. In this case, let's say one unit of time, could be 100 years, could be 10 years, whatever, and the concentration is one unit, could be 10 ppm, could be 100 ppb, whatever that number is, right? And if you, so now we look at different ways of kind of conceptual remediation, what would that lead to? And the first thing is, the example is you dig out the top half of that, and maybe you don't dig out because it's too deep after that, or you need shoring, et cetera, or your assessment was incomplete. If you did that, the longevity does not decrease, and the concentration just would decrease by at least, because it's idealized, we say it's 50%, but the concentrations could go down. If you take a third case where you dig out some portion of it, but not the entire source, and maybe there's a building on top on the right-hand side that you couldn't access, or again, your assessment is incomplete, and you didn't do a good job with the assessment. And if you take that scenario, your duration goes down by a factor of 2 because you got half the mass out, but your concentrations don't change, right? And if you take in the base case, say you have L-NAPL in monitoring wells, and you put in a pump and treat system, and you hydraulically recover some of the NAPL, and say you are able to reduce the NAPL saturation by 20%, which is not kind of optimistic or pessimistic, that's typically kind of numbers that you get removed from most formations, if that. In some cases, you'll get more in coarse material and finer material. You won't get that reduction, but conceptually, let's say you got 20% reduction in saturation, right? So So your pores contain 20% less oil than they did before your removal. In that case, your concentration really does not go down. It's the duration that will go down by a proportionate amount of time. Again, think of the previous slide. Because you haven't changed that X, that mole fraction, all you've done is reduce the amount, so the concentration doesn't change, the duration does. And finally, if you are able to change the composition, and instead of removing the oil as a whole, you are able to target, magically target that one chemical, say benzene, and get benzene reduced by a certain amount, say 80% in this case, what will happen is your concentration would go down by 80%. Again, think of that X in the previous term. That X has gone from whatever it was before to 20% of that number, so the concentration is 20%. The duration really does not change in this case because you haven't really reduced much of the mass. So this gives you an idea of, this previous slide should have, there's a glitch on this slide. So I'll refer you to the paper. The data is not showing on this slide, and you'll have to take my word for it and have to look up the original. So this is a work that we did, Shell did, looking at 4,000 sites in California. Of the 4,000 sites, 1,000 sites, so 4,000 were from GeoTracker. It's all public domain information. About 1,000 sites, 970 sites had L-NAPLIN monitoring wells. Of those 970 sites, about half of them had some recovery system, half of them didn't. And what we did was compare, was the longevity different in sites where recovery was done versus recovery wasn't done? And there wasn't really a big difference. So again, I apologize. It looks fine on my end, and like when I downloaded the slide, but it's not looking, it's missing the data, at least on this version that's showing up here. So this is slide 40. Going to slide 41. So I've talked about changing composition. So how do you change composition? There are different physical or chemical properties of different chemicals that are in a mixture that you can exploit to do that. One of them is solubility of the compound. It's vapor pressure, basically how volatile the compound is from oil. It's Henry's law constant, how volatile it's from water. So things can be volatile out of oil, but not out of water, and vice versa. So you got to know both those things depending on what you're trying to do. And I'm on slide 41 again. And biodegradation, again, some chemicals are go faster under certain conditions, certain electron acceptors. So basically the red line is kind of the instructors or the, not even the instructors, the team that we had, the LNAPL team, their best judgment, and there's, it's supported by some literature, actually a fair bit of literature, is the number, is the line where you say, okay, anything above that line is amenable to that technology. So if you're looking at MTB, TBA, at least in the US, it's out, but when it used to be there, those are the two compounds that you could actually dissolve out because they have enough solubility, so you can do pump and treat. If you're talking about the BTEX type compounds, benzene, toluene, MTB, those are amenable to an SVE type technology. And if you look at the volatilization for water, that's largely air sparge. So at that time, MTB, which is not that volatile out of water, it's volatile out of oil, so it's not really good for MTBE, but it's good for the BTEX type compounds, right? And again, biodegradation, it just tells you that BTEX type compounds degrade, and sometimes people add different electron acceptors to speed it up. People add oxygen, people add just pure air, biospars, things like that to really earn. Some people add sulfate. So you could introduce electron acceptor to preferentially deplete some of these soluble compounds or relatively more soluble compounds. So quickly going to a knowledge check. Consider a site where you have gasoline release and you've got monitoring wells and you see some LNAPL in monitoring wells, and your site goal is to reduce benzene concentration in groundwater in a couple of years. And your options are, hey, there's LNAPL in monitoring well, I need to just pump it out and that'll take care of the benzene. I need to figure out a way to change the composition of LNAPL, or just let MNA do its thing and it'll take some. So a fair bit of you have responded, about a third, maybe more than a third have responded by now, and I think the general consensus, which is basically we've got to figure out a way to change the LNAPL composition. Your removal of LNAPL may be a regulatory requirement, but it won't help you with your benzene objective. And with that, I will hand over to Natasha to continue with the next key message.
Thanks, Sanjay. So we are now on slide 43, and we'll be talking about key message number 4, which is that all apparent NAPL thicknesses are not created equal. So we'll be talking about apparent NAPL thickness in unconfined conditions. All right, so one important thing to look at here, and I apologize, this does not look like it's rendering properly on the screen, but hopefully you can see this on the printed out version. We are looking at the moisture retention curve and thinking about the importance of understanding the different soil types at your site for understanding fluid behavior under different types of geologic conditions. So getting back to thinking about these laboratory-based measurements and understanding how saturation will change in different types of media. So here on the left-hand side, we have the capillary pressure for two different materials. In the light pink, we have the sand, and in the maroon, we have the clay. And this is really just to highlight the wide range of capillary pressures and saturations that we can have in the types of material that we see at our site. So the relationship between these capillary pressures and fluid saturations can be established in the lab using the moisture retention curve. That's a standard laboratory method. And this provides us some information, important information, about how fluid will behave at our site and how NAPL will behave at our site. We don't need to take these measurements for all of the different types of sites that we have, but it's important to understand the differences in terms of how different material will behave. So for the sand, we can see that it's relatively easy for a fluid to move in and out of that material because of its structure. And in contrast, for a clay, it's very difficult for a fluid to move into the clay or to drain out of the clay because of its structure. And that will have implications for the NAPL behavior in those materials as well. Moving on to the next slide, we'll look at those grain size effects on NAPL distribution. So here we have a plot showing a profile for the same NAPL thickness in a well. So on the right-hand side, we have this thickness of gasoline in our well. And then we're looking at the height above the water table for the LNAPL interface for these different types of materials. So we can see that for the silt shown here on the far left, the NAPL is not penetrating very far into the formation to have, or with that height of gasoline in the well. In contrast, for a gravel, where we have a very coarse grain material, we have a lot more NAPL in the formation to facilitate that height of NAPL in our well. And so it's really important to understand our lithology when we're thinking about that NAPL architecture in the formation. And I think this is maybe, people are a little beyond this now, but just to highlight the difference from an older concept here that we can have this pancake model where we have the NAPL in the formation at the same thickness or the same height as the NAPL in the well, and just highlighting the difference between that concept and what we actually see for the different types of materials that we have, and consequently the amount of NAPL in the formation. All right, so now moving on to slide 46, we'll look at in-well naphtha thickness for relative saturations in a silty sand. So in this case, we're looking at the same soil type. In the last slide, we were looking at different soil types. And here we're looking for this silty sand. So we're seeing that for a higher thickness in the well, we have a higher capillary pressure, and that's leading to higher naphthol saturation. So shown here on the bottom, for a 1 foot thickness in our well, we only have about 2.5% naphthol saturation. And then if we move all the way out to a 10 foot thickness, we're up closer to a 35% naphthol saturation. So really just to illustrate the difference for a particular soil type with different heights of naphthol above the water table. And a cute little graphic there to remind you that we often talk about this shark fin model. So this this curvature of the naphthol in the formation resembles a shark fin, and that's something you probably have seen or probably will hear when people are talking about this. Now, sort of putting this together in terms of understanding how we would have naphthol behavior in the formation associated with different soil types. So on the left-hand side, we have an example for a homogeneous soil type. So just one soil type here, and the triangles show us our measured data, and the line shows us our modeled data. So we can see here that for the homogeneous soil type, we have a relatively well-behaved scenario where our model fits relatively well to the measured data. And then on the right-hand side, we have a heterogeneous soil type. So here we have, in the circles, you see six different soil types. And just how much more challenging that is to understand the naphthol architecture when we have that variation in the soil type. And of course, the right-hand side is much more similar to what we see at our site. And again, just illustrating the importance of understanding the different soil types that you have across the vertical extent that you're looking at and the implications for the naphthol saturations that will be associated with those soil types or those changes in soil types. And there are a couple references there for you if you're interested in looking at that in a little more detail. And with that, I'll pass it back to Sanjay.
All right. Thanks, Natasha. So this is the last session before a break. And you've heard us mention about thickness. Randy mentioned it, I mentioned it, and we all did, Natasha did. And basically now I'll cover the challenges with thickness as a metric, as an indicator, what it tells us, what it doesn't tell us, et cetera, and why it changes in different types of scenarios. The video is coming up, so. Do I need to press something here? Okay. Nope. So basically what you're seeing here is a ill naphthol body that's kind of the pulsating heart in the middle. And on the right-hand side, you have this bar that shows the groundwater elevation, right? And as the groundwater is dropping, you see this footprint of ill naphthol kind of getting bigger. And like as of now, the water table is rising and the ill naphthol is depleted. And you'll see that kind of repeat with time. And now this is the perfect time to close your site. And oops, water table dropped again, and you got naphthol again, right? So can we go into the next slide, or can I go back to the presentation mode again? All right. So for those for whom the video didn't play for whatever reason or had a lag, this slide is basically, this is slide 50 now. This slide is screen grabs from that video playing, okay? And the key thing to remember here is that when, if you look at the September 1986 timeframe, or the April 1985, or compared to April 1982, any of the periods where the ill naphthol is kind of at its maximum to the times when the water table is high and the ill naphthol is not at minimum or it's not there, really nothing's changed from a risk perspective, right? The LNAPL body is the same size. The amount of LNAPL in the ground is about the same size. There was some recovery going on at the site, but nothing substantial. So it's largely a perception of, if you're in September 1986, everything's good. You only have a groundwater problem. And if you're in April 1985, you've got a NAPL problem, right? So I think that's the part of the mindset that we'll try to address now and through this full three-session internet-based training. So, but why does that happen? What you saw on the previous slide, what's the science behind it, right? So if you look at the slide here, what you see on the left and right is a tank experiment done at Colorado State University by a student of Dr. Tom Sale. And what you see in the middle is kind of a conceptualization, a conceptual explanation of what's happening. So on the left-hand side, the water table is high. You've got this big smear zone, and you've got higher LNAPL towards the air-NAPL interface, basically top of that LNAPL. And you've got a certain amount of LNAPL, right? On the right-hand side, as the water table drops, that what used to be a saturated zone becomes a vado zone. And the capacity of the vado zone, the unsaturated zone, to hold NAPL is lesser than that of the saturated zone, right? So that NAPL is now free or freer to accumulate in a well. It's the same amount of LNAPL in the formation, but it's now accumulating in a well because its distribution in the formation has changed. The vado zone can't hold as much. And that's what you saw in the previous slide. And for the practitioners and consultants and whoever's kind of been and doing this in the field, what you see here in these, I'm slide 52, sorry. The views A, B, and C are basically the same information. They're for different worlds, different sites, but just different ways that people present this information, that the thickness of LNAPL is increasing with drop in groundwater elevation, right? And if you see that behavior, when the groundwater drops, your thickness increases, it gives you an indication that the LNAPL is occurring under unconfined conditions. And the picture on the bottom left side is something that's become more common now. We call it the diagnostic gauge plot, and it helps you kind of understand the hydrogeologic condition that your NAPL is occurring under. So if you see, you'll see a couple more scenarios in the next few slides to kind of see how to use this. But if you see this kind of behavior, your NAPL water is dropping, and your air NAPL is kind of tracking it, but it's kind of getting a bit divergent, that means it's a unconfined condition. The other scenario that's not very common, but you'll encounter it, especially where you have interbedded soils, and interbedded soil in the kind of smear zone area or right near the water table. NAPL sometimes will come down from the vado zone, as we've seen, and it'll sit on this tighter material. And it doesn't have to be very tight. It doesn't have to be clay. It's just sufficiently tight enough that it doesn't penetrate that formation. And your water level is deeper. Basically, LNAPL just sees that monitoring well. If it's screened across that perching layer, it sees that as a conduit, it accumulates, right? And as the water table drops, more NAPL flows into the well. So that's what the second half of the second run, so the second graphic shows on the two that are similar. And basically, if you do that time series over time, over seasons, the top of the NAPL really does not change, right? So the air NAPL is about the same over time, but the thickness changes because as the water is going down, the NAPL is just filling up that space until it comes to some sort of a quasi-steady state type situation. And when you plot that, basically you'll see your NAPL water, which is the blue line in this diagnostic gauge plot on the top right, is going down. The air NAPL is kind of flat. And if you get that kind of a shape of your diagnostic gauge plot, it tells you that your NAPL is purged. And it all becomes important. We'll tie it together in a few more slides. And the bottom graph is basically just showing conceptually what I've described conceptually for an actual site. This is another situation, now I'm on slide 54, where NAPL can be trapped below a confining layer. Again, the graphic shows clay. It could be just something tighter than gravel. Even medium sand, fine sand can create that condition because it's just NAPL cannot penetrate it. So you've got this NAPL in the left-hand panel, and the water table starts rising. And as the water table starts rising, it hits this finer grain material at some point, which is shown on the right-hand side picture. And the NAPL cannot enter the formation, but it's got this conduit in this form of monitoring well, and it'll fill that monitoring well up. So your water table, if the NAPL is confined and your water table is rising, your water table, basically the NAPL keeps rising as your water table increases. The NAPL thickness keeps increasing as your water level increases, or potentiometric surface increases. And what you see if you plot the diagnostic gauge plot is the NAPL water interface. If you look at the graphic on the right-hand side, right, imagine that water table rising even more. You'll see with that squiggly there, the water table can keep rising. Because it's confined, just the NAPL will exert itself in that monitoring well as just filling up that monitoring well. The mental picture I have is kind of thinking of an inverted syringe, and you keep pressing it from the bottom, and your needle keeps getting fuller and fuller. So you could plot these historical data and kind of understand why your NAPL is behaving a certain way. Your thickness is increasing with increase in potentiometric surface. Then you have a confined case. And this is an example where if you go to the previous slide and think about it, on the left side, till the NAPL becomes confined, it'll behave like unconfined. Those are the blue dots here. And when the NAPL reaches that interface, the behavior changes, and you see this NAPL thickness increase with elevations. So on the left half of this graph, you see the NAPL thickness drop as the water table is increasing. And on the right side, it's the opposite. And if you look at the boring log for that particular site or for that particular well, right at about 800 feet elevation, there is the silty sand. So as the water level increases and hits that silty sand, that's where it becomes confined. Another unique situation is fractured rock, or in Texas or other places where you've got this clay, you'll have these macro pores, which could be fissures due to desiccation, root fissures, things like that. And basically, the NAPL just sits in these little pores, and the rest of the formation is quote-unquote clean. There's no NAPL. So the picture on the left is a section of a boring log, or not of a core from Texas clay, and you slice it, and what you see is the little white holes with little bit of oil oozing out, right? And imagine now in that formation, you've got a monitoring well that intercepts these little pores, or little macro pores. If there's sufficient oil in this network over a period of months, years, that LNAPL will flow into the monitoring well, and it'll basically fill up that well to wherever the potentiometric surface is. So you can potentially see large accumulations in wells, but once you evacuate that well, it can take months, sometimes years, to actually come back in again. So we've had sites, or people have had sites, we've got 30, 40 feet of LNAPL in well, and people plan on recovering those, recovering the NAPL and putting a system, and you recover some, and then it stops, and then it's all good till it starts accumulating, and it takes, you go back after a year, and you've got an accumulation again. So kind of makes you think whether that 30-foot accumulation, I'm using the 30 feet for exaggeration, is that 30 foot worse than 6 inches in clay or in gravel? Where can you recover more? And I'll kind of leave that as a question to discuss later. Why is this important, what I discussed? Because as we all know, once you see a thickness in a well, it drives certain behavior, it drives certain response and expectations. I'm in slide 57 now. Drives certain response. People think there will be recovery. There's perception that it will be migrating. It's important to understand what's causing that high thickness, whether it's really NAPL that's in large amount that needs to be recovered, or it's be one of these unique conditions. No, they're not unique, but special conditions that's causing that increased thickness. And last slide before the break, slide 58. So you got a site, you got 7 feet of LNAPL in a well, and there's heavy rainy season, the LNAPL increases to 9 feet, 10 feet. What's likely happening at the site? And looks like people are on the right track. I've got about 70 or so odd people respond, and over 95% kind of have identified that it is and confined condition, because you're, again, think about the diagnostic gauge plot, think about the inverted needle, whatever makes you remember it. When water level increases, if the thickness increases, you've got a confined case. And with that, I will hand over to Tadbir for the Q&A session.
Thank you, Sanjay. At this time, we'll open the question and answer portion of our training. For those of you on the phone lines that are interested in asking a question, I will give you the opportunity to do so in just a moment. Remember, it's #6 to unmute your line and *6 to remute. For anyone else, at this time, you can type your questions in the Q&A pod at the bottom right corner of your screen, and we will try to get through as many of those questions as we can. Just a reminder for those of you that are interested in receiving certificates of completion, that they will be available upon completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click the box to certify you participated, that certificate will be provided to you. So let's go to our phone lines. If you would like to ask a question out loud, this is your opportunity to do so. Once again, it's #6 to unmute. Okay, hearing no questions, we did receive a question on the Adobe Connect software, so I will read it out loud. Given trends observed in the video, do you advise adjusting screening levels, or does the lack of LNAPL at high water still provide useful data in site evaluation and LNAPL treatment/collection?
In that particular case, the LNAPL does not show up in monitoring wells, not because the screens are not in the right place. It just doesn't show up because it's trapped. It won't flow regardless of whether you got it fully screened or not. And that's also clear from the subsequent slide. That's the kind of lab experiment.
Thanks for the answer, Sanjay. We do have another question. What sampling frequency do you recommend for contaminated sites? That is, how often per year to sample?
All right, I'll provide a purely technical response, right? So there's a regulatory requirement and things like that you'll have to respond to and kind of use. On a new site, if you think about it, a lot of things define it. your distance receptor, your material that's leaked, the history that you have for the site. If you've got several years of data, getting every quarter really doesn't add much information. Whereas if you've had a new release and you've got neighbors nearby and got gravel and sand, maybe you want to monitor quarterly even sooner. So it just depends on a site-by-site condition, but on a steady state, typical site where things have reached some sort of a steady state, then you are looking for changes in that steady state and you don't really need to do it very often. I mean, we've got sites where we do quarterly, we've got sites where we do once in 2 years. Or a combination sometimes, right? So there are wells that are particularly showing a trend increasing or decreasing, you go more often there. There are wells that are stable or in the middle of the plume, really not doing much, you don't go very often. So it's not a one-size-fits-all answer, unfortunately.
Thanks, Sanjay. We have another question. Would use of ISCO or carbon technology change El Napo composition effectively?
So we haven't covered that here. I think you'll hear more in subsequent training, but carbon probably could. ISCO is more indiscriminate in terms of what it degrades. So ISCO really doesn't go, okay, I'll go after benzene and not after alkane of some kind. That's not soluble. Whereas carbon would actually, it's more of a sorption technology. So if you're injecting some sort of carbon in the ground, it potentially could go for composition, but I don't have first-hand experience with that.
I would just add there as well that I think effectively is the key word in that question, that when we think about some of these different technologies, and as Sanjay mentioned, there'll be more on this in later sections, that you know, we need to think about the chemical loading and what would be required to affect any kind of change, and we often that that's not an effective solution because of the amount of chemical that would be needed or the amount of mixing that would be needed. So that's another piece to consider there.
Is it still appropriate to generate contour maps, El Napo thickness in a given well network since the thickness in the well is an accumulation, not part of a connected body?
I will start. I don't do it. I don't look for it. I think the more recent trend, which is more informative, is people have started plotting transmissivity maps to see where NAPL is recoverable. If you do thicknesses, just because of reasons we described earlier, it's not very informative, just depends on what people are looking for, what your stakeholder expectations are. Sometimes you have to plot these maps. But thicknesses usually aren't very informative, especially if you start kriging, as the question asks. Now you are trying to connect two dots, which may be two different releases. And it kind of says this particular release is connected to, right, you're extrapolating between those two points without knowing whether the two indicate the same release. So it's kind of a bit more extrapolation than one would do when you create groundwater data, for example.
Can I just add, this is Randy, for a regulatory mindset, and this goes to the question that was just asked about sampling. One of the real reasons that we want to do these webinars and we're hoping to get everybody up to date on the key concepts in the science is to understand, both from a regulated standpoint, the regulatory agency and the case managers, to understand this isn't dissolve phase. This El Napo is different. And so I will say that we are still, both in the regulated community and in the consulting community, understanding what we're looking at. So, for dissolve phase, I just sample four times a year. That's a totally different question. You know, just because you've been doing it in the past doesn't mean you need to do it now. Same thing with the contour maps. You might use those for dissolve phase, but that same analysis or well, it's just a map. It may not tell you the it's not going to tell you the same thing for an LNAPL contour map. So this is part of this whole webinar and these updated documents is so that both sides of the table understand you are dealing with something different and it needs to be looked at in a different way than your classic groundwater. So this is where we're hoping that you, the regulated community, as well as the consultants and the stakeholders, can have those conversations so everyone understands what they're looking at and don't just collect data for the sake of collecting data. Collect data that tells you something and is something that is meaningful and useful.
Okay, moving on to the next question. What is the usual minimum/maximum time frame that LNAPL should appear, assuming that conditions will support accumulation in a well?
I was waiting for somebody else to take on, but I'll start again. Depends on the formation. Depends on the proximity of the monitoring well to your LNAPL body, where the LNAPL is. So I was mentioning earlier that in the example where we had the fractured formation or macro pores in clay, in those kind of sites, it could take a long time for LNAPL to accumulate, months to years. And if you have gravel and coarse sand, it could be to the order of days, even sooner.
Okay, thanks so much for the questions and for the trainers for providing the answers. We are going to now move on to the second portion of our training today. We do have some more questions that have been answered in the Q&A pod, and we will get to those in our final Q&A at the end of this class. With that, I will move on to slide 60 and let Natasha take over.
Thanks. In this section, we'll talk about the next key message, which is that mobile NAPL does not necessarily mean that the NAPL is migrating. So we're really building here on the concepts that we've been talking about in terms of the amount of NAPL present and how it's going to behave in different types of lithologies. Moving on to slide 61, we're first going to talk about some of the broader considerations for NAPL management. This really builds on some of the discussion about the regulatory context that we had in the Q&A section. So we'll begin on the left-hand side with the NAPL emergency issues. In this case, we're looking at things like safety issues from explosion or direct contact with NAPL. And then moving to the middle panel, we're looking at issues related to vapor and groundwater pathways. These are common risk pathways that are addressed in most of the state and federal regulations. And finally, on the right panel, there are additional considerations for when NAPL is present in wells, which is potential NAPL mobility or other aspects that may be relevant due to the presence of NAPL in wells, such as aesthetic considerations or reputational or liability concerns. In the next slide, we'll be focusing on the fourth point, which is NAPL mobility. The first thing that we want to think about in terms of NAPL mobility is understanding how the NAPL will actually be transported. So just like we have Darcy's Law for groundwater, it also controls the movement of NAPL. However, because NAPL and groundwater coexist and share pore space, we need to be conscious that we're not just dealing with a single fluid. So in the next slide, we'll be looking at how Darcy's Law relates to transport of NAPL. A couple of key things that we need to consider here are the properties of the fluid and the forces on the fluid. And we'll be looking again at the properties that are related to NAPL specifically, as illustrated in the top right of this slide. So while we have the Darcy's Law for groundwater on the top, we need to be considering the properties of the fluid for NAPL to understand its transport. On slide 63, we'll can look at NAPL conductivity. So we have the NAPL density and viscosity that need to be considered here, highlighted in green on your slide. And it's worth considering how changes in these parameters affect NAPL flow. So for example, an increase in the relative permeability of that NAPL increases the oil conductivity and the flow rate. The relative permeability can vary over many orders of magnitude. Similarly, an increase in density also increases the NAPL flow rate. However, since changes in density are small, this is not such an important parameter with respect to mobility. Finally, there's viscosity, which is of moderate importance, with an opposite trend shown where an increase in viscosity decreases the NAPL flow rate. And if you think about other types of fluids, you can see that sort of makes sense. You know, if you're thinking about the highly viscous fluid like molasses in comparison to something like water, obviously you would expect that to not flow quite as quickly. So here's an illustration of this concept, and this actually ties back to one of the questions that we had in the break, understanding how quickly NAPL will move into new environments. So on the left-hand side of this slide, 64, we're looking at an initial time, and the red is showing the NAPL. The dashed blue line is showing the groundwater gradient, and the red line is showing the NAPL gradient. And so we can see here that for a finite release, the NAPL flattens out over time. And here we have another illustrative example from a sand tank looking at that NAPL behavior, showing similar to what we see conceptually in the top half of the slide, showing that initially we have this NAPL accumulation, and then that gradient dissipates as it moves further into the formation. And that dissipation happens relatively quickly. So what's really driving, or what's controlling, I suppose, this NAPL behavior? So when NAPL moves into a new pore, when it migrates to a new location, it has to overcome any pressures that are existing there. So for a water wet media, the NAPL has to push the water out of the way in order for it to move further into the formation. So soil pores are less wetting to NAPL than they are to water, which means that NAPL encounters resistance so that it tries to move into an adjacent pore. If you think about NAPL moving through the unsaturated zone in contrast, it's easier for NAPL to push that air out of the way than it is for it to push water out of the way. So it has an easier time with migration in comparison to the saturated zone. And just to point out here, that pore entry pressure is the resistance to the NAPL, which is encountered when it's trying to move into a pre-existing groundwater-filled pore, and that's what needs to be overcome for any migration to occur. Now, there are a number of other reasons why NAPL could be stabilized, and this is something that we picked up in the later section of this training course, I believe in the third session of the series. And that's the natural source zone depletion. In this case, we have different processes which are acting on the NAPL to degrade or destroy the NAPL, and that can also lead to the arrestment of the NAPL body. So in this case, we have volatilization and biodegradation occurring, and that's really stopping the NAPL from continuing to migrate in the formation and potentially even shrinking the NAPL plume. Next, on slide 67, we'll look at a few different lines of evidence that we consider for understanding the NAPL body behavior. So our first line of evidence is going to be our gauging data. We'll look at our monitoring results, assuming, of course, that we have an adequate well network to identify the extent of the NAPL and identify if NAPL is migrating into any new wells. And that would be our sentinel well in this case. And as Sanjay mentioned and illustrated in the video, we do need to be aware of water table fluctuations when evaluating the NAPL thickness so that we're not missing key pieces of information. And having that water table information is very valuable to understand how the NAPL is behaving in our formation. The second line of evidence that we'll look at on slide 68 is the groundwater data. So this is our dissolved plume data. This will help us characterize the extent of the NAPL and also understand whether or not we have any natural attenuation processes occurring. So we can look at our geochemical data in our groundwater data to understand if we have a NAPL body that is potentially degrading or the groundwater plume surrounding that NAPL body is degrading. And this will help us understand if we have a shrinking NAPL body, if we have a shrinking groundwater plume, similar to what we talked about early on in terms of understanding the concentrations of particular chemicals of concern in relation to whether or not there's a NAPL feeding that groundwater plume. If we see a shrinking groundwater plume, that can indicate to us that we have a shrinking NAPL body. We can have a stable groundwater plume, which could indicate either a stable or shrinking NAPL body. And then if we have an expanding plume, that's a much more complex situation and could mean that we have potentially an expanding NAPL body. The third line of evidence that we can look at is the measured NAPL thickness. And so similar to what we were thinking about in terms of understanding the chemical concentration in relation to its solubility and understanding the CSAT in the TPH in the soil, here we can look at a measure of the likelihood of NAPL to intrude into new pores, and that's our critical thickness measurement. So this is, of course, going to vary based on our lithology and based on the NAPL type. And what this is telling us is whether or not we have sufficient NAPL present to push the water out of the way and migrate into a new pore. So we see here for a sand, we have a critical thickness of gasoline of 0.7 feet, and that's different from the case of a diesel here, 1 foot. And then thinking back to those shark fins and, you know, the amount of NAPL present that needs to be present in order for the NAPL to intrude further into the formation, if we have a much tighter material here like a silty clay, the critical thickness of NAPL is much higher. Which means we need more of that NAPL to be pushing onto the formation for it to intrude into the adjacent pore. There are a number of other lines of evidence that are discussed in the guidance document, but that we'll just go through briefly here. NAPL transmissivity, as Sanjay mentioned, understanding the NAPL transmissivity for your site can be valuable for understanding of recovery potential. Understanding the age of the release, as we talked about, we can have these releases occur, but they dissipate relatively quickly. So understanding how old relatively the age of the release can help you understand if you have the potential for migration or mobility. Looking at changing recovery rates, if we have a remediation system in place and we have declining recovery rates, that gives us important information for understanding the sort of lifetime of that NAPL body. We can look at laboratory tests, such as the Dean-Stark test that we looked at earlier, to understand if we're at or above residual saturation, whether our NAPL is likely to be held in place, or if there's potential for any mobility or migration. And lastly, we can look at tracer tests, which is an indicator of the NAPL movement in a well. All right, so now moving on to slide 71, we'll look at a case example, or a couple of case examples from what we see at our sites. A couple of things to keep in mind here. NAPL can spread at initial rates that are higher than groundwater flow because the NAPL is driven by the gradient on the NAPL itself, and we'll illustrate this in an example coming up. Similarly, the NAPL can spread in a direction opposite to the groundwater gradient, radial spreading, again, because we have NAPL that is controlled by its own gradient. And finally, after a NAPL release is abated, L-NAPL bodies come to a stable configuration in a relatively short period of time. So as we saw from that sand tank experiment, I believe in that case a few slides ago, that was about 3 hours, obviously a small release in that case, but relatively quick dissipation of that gradient. And we see that in the real world as well. Now we have a case study to illustrate that. So our first case study here we have on slide 72. This is an example of measured data at a pipeline crude oil release site. The upper left figure shows a plan view showing the spread of NAPL thickness over time. So we see in the gray area the spread between when the release initially occurred in February of 2000 and October of 2001. So here we see in this gray area, that's the initial change. And then the blue and yellow zone represent the additional spreading between October of 2001 and December of 2002. So something important to pay attention to in this figure is that the NAFL spreads radially from the release location and not only in the direction of groundwater flow. So here we have the direction of groundwater flow moving from the top left across to the sort of to the bottom right. Then you can see that the NAFL is spreading in opposition to that gradient, controlled by the gradient on the NAFL itself. Now the figure in the lower right shows the estimated rate of NAFL spreading. And so initially you see it's on the order of a few feet per day. And then after about a year and a half, it decreases to a few feet per year. So we can see that initially this rate of spreading is quite high. And then, I apologize, this is not rendering quite properly, but hopefully you can interpret it here. So initially we have this rate of spreading that's quite high, and then it drops off relatively quickly and is spreading relatively slowly after that. So after December 2002, no additional NAFL was observed to migrate into the Sentinel wells, those clean wells that we're using to identify the any spreading. The NAFL plume is considered now to be functionally stable. And so that's a state or condition where there's some vertical and lateral redistribution. So things might be internally moving around a little bit, but we're not having any major changes that are going to impact the management of the site itself. So we're calling this functionally stable overall, and we can now move forward with whatever work we need to do. The dissolved concentrations in groundwater are also measured routinely and indicate, similar to the other data that we have, that the dissolved plume is stabilized around the NAFL footprint and the smear zone. And so that's an example of looking at your groundwater data as well to understand how the NAFL is behaving. Moving on to slide 73, we'll look at another case study here. This is from another crude oil pipeline release in Bemidji in northern Minnesota. Excuse me, we have a pipeline running here with a release point and that little red circle on the top left. This is our NAFL body shown in the contours, and here we're looking at LIF signatures along the leading edge of that NAFL body. So we see that our oil thicknesses decrease as we move towards the leading edge, and that at the penultimate LIF location, the oil thickness is about 0.7 feet, which is less than the calculated critical thickness for this condition, which was about 1.2 to 1.6 feet. So just another example of how you can use some of the calculations and data that we've been discussing in this course. The last case example is also from the Bemidji site, and this shows the differences between the rates of spreading versus the rates of mass depletion. So we touched on this a moment ago in terms of the natural source zone depletion stabilizing or degrading the NAFL body, and again, this will be brought up in more detail in the third session of this course. And in this case, we're looking at the NAFL body in the vadose zone and floating on the water table. And then we're using measurements of carbon dioxide flux to estimate the mass loss due to biodegradation at the site. And seeing that we have the NAFL body being stabilized due to the biodegradation that's occurring. Moving on to slide 75, a couple of things to consider in terms of migration potential and stability. A few things to take away here. Mobile NAFL is not necessarily migrating NAFL. So just because we have NAFL in the well doesn't mean it's moving. It's held there due to a number of different forces that we've talked about. The principle of Darcy's law, the principles apply similar to NAFL as they do to groundwater. And consider as well that NAFL can spread radially away from a release due to the gradient on the NAFL itself. In order for NAFL to migrate, it needs to overcome the pore entry pressure and to push that water out of the way to migrate into the adjacent pore. There are processes which lead to the NAFL stability, such as natural source zone depletion, which again you'll learn more about in the third section of this course. And like so many of the things that we do, we really want to use multiple lines of evidence to assess the NAFL stability and really develop that conceptual model for our site. And now I will hand it back to Sanjay to talk about key message number 7.
All right, thanks, Natasha. So we will now in the next half a dozen of slides, talk about transmissivity. So this is just a starter. There's a whole lot more in the next internet-based training on transmissivity. So now I am on slide 77. What you see on the slide is essentially a summary of a lot of the thickness discussion we've had so far between Natasha and myself. On the top left, you've got this unconfined NLAPL, just flows into the well. The thickness in the formation is somewhat similar to thickness in the well, minus there's a bit of smear zone. But then you can have a thickness, and the thickness means different amounts of NLAPL in the formation. That's the right-hand side figure over here, basically different sizes of shark fins, right? And then we talked about confined, where this was a bottom-up filling hole. And then we talked about perched, where it was a top-down filling hole, just in exaggerating the thickness of LNAPL in wells. So kind of tells you the challenge with the thickness. And when Natasha talked about conductivity and Darcy's law, et cetera, that basically we talk about NAPL conductivity. It accounts for anything for NAPL to flow, right? So the things that affect NAPL's flow other than the gradient are the viscosity, which is the denominator. There's the relative permeability, basically, which means if there's more NAPL, it just flows easier in the formation. The small k over here, that is basically just the conductivity of the Darcy permeability of the soil. And so this NAPL conductivity is an important concept. Right, so let's just try to bring all of that together to see how can we use some of the basic science to make a more intelligent decision. And the science has been there for a long, long time, and we've all used it, and we are familiar with groundwater transmissivity. All that groundwater transmissivity says is the amount of water that can flow, that's discharged, when you apply a unit gradient, and how much, like, water is discharged through a 1 square foot or 1 unit area cross section, right? And you take that transmissivity, so basically it's doing that conductivity times thickness of that water interval to kind of give you the total transmissivity. You could do the same thing with LNAPL. So I'm on slide 79. And I'll start from the bottom. So basically drawing an analog between the equation that you saw on the previous slide, slide 78, and the terms here, basically all we've done is change W for N, water for NAPL, right? And KN accounts for your formation, which is this small k. It accounts for how much NAPL is there in this terms, residual relative permeability. It accounts for whether you've got crude oil or gasoline in that viscosity, and this NAPL term, which is less sensitive. But you've accounted for all of that. And then the interval that's important, the not the thickness in the well, but the formation interval. You account for all that, and basically you do some manipulation with algebra, and it's simple as that, that you come up with this equation where it says your discharge is your transmissivity times your gradient. Right? So if you can induce a NAPL gradient, then your transmissivity tells you how much oil you'll recover. Going to slide 80 now. So we talked about that TN equals KN times BN. So what is that BN? What's the thickness? It's not this thickness. So I'll do the example for confined and perched first. So it's not this thickness in a well. It's not the 30 foot that I mentioned in Texas. it's that few feet or few inches, whatever it may be, that's actually where the napple sits in the formation, not where the napple sits in the well. Same thing with perch, right? So if you go to the right-hand side figure, this is slide 80, it's not this thickness that's accumulated in the monitoring well, that's your BN. Your BN is the actual formation that's impacted, that's got this flowing napple. And for unconfined, it's a closer match between what you see in the wells versus what you see in the formation. Yes, you have to account for the fact that there's some smear zone, but it's still, there's a bit of correlation between unconfined, it's unconfined thickness in a well and what's in the formation, and absolutely none in perch and confined conditions. So you've got to think about that equation of the things that you would intuitively think affects flow: soil type, viscosity, gradient, how much napple is there, and what condition, what's the thickness in the formation, not in the well. So you account for all that, and that becomes your single term, which is transmissivity. And the ITRC documentation, TechReg, recommends, based on our experience, the instructors and the whole team, not just the instructor, sorry, this range of about 0.1 to 0.8 square foot per day, maybe something less than 1 square foot per day. And basically, to give a sense of what that means, and this is just a thought experiment, a modeling experiment, not a thought experiment, a modeling experiment done for unconfined conditions for different soil types. And so the soil type has a different hydraulic conductivity. Silty loam is a foot per day and 100 feet per day for medium size. And if you have certain thicknesses in a well or in the formation, what transmissivity would you have for that kind of material, for that napple in that formation? And by the time you are, so it gives you a kind of a sense, if you look at silty loam and sandy loam, let's start with silty loam, that's the bottom, right? You get 5 feet of napple in a well or in the formation, and you have less than 0.8 square foot per day for gasoline. And you get to something a little bit more permeable, still not a whole lot more. Again, you can have a couple of feet in the formation and still fairly low transmissivity. It's by the time you get to the fine sand, medium sand, and coarser material that you actually start getting some meaningful transmissivity for gasoline. And then there's a difference between gasoline and diesel because of the viscosity differences. I think the viscosity is by a factor of 6. And then there's a different relative permeability curve for both. So it gives you a sense. All the slides meant to do is give you a feel of what numbers to expect. Largely why we use napple transmissivity as a metric, in concept, there's this residual saturation, which is a term or an amount of fluid or liquid in a medium below which it can't flow. So think about a sponge, your kitchen foam. It's soaking with water. It's got mobile water in there. You start squeezing it, and the water starts dripping out. And at some point, you are putting in a lot of pressure, and a couple of drops are coming out. And there is a theoretical point where you can apply, no matter how much pressure you apply, there's no more water that comes out. So when you're applying this high level of energy, whatever that high is, and a few drops come out, that's the low transmissivity range. When you squeeze it out absolutely and nothing comes out, that's a theoretical residual saturation, right? So the literature, the oil literature, the petroleum literature, has always defined residual saturation in that concept of practicability. It doesn't go to the molecular or pore level definition like the environmental or the academic literature does. So the petroleum literature, those are the first two definitions. They say the oil that remains in a reservoir at depletion or oil that remains after a water flood has reached an economic limit, right? So those are the practical limits or practical definitions of residual saturation. And the bottom definition there are all kind of academic type definitions comes from the environmental literature. And they say that when it becomes discontinuous and is mobilized with capillary forces, and which is correct, which is the more accurate definition, but there's a bit of that gray zone practicability where, yes, it hasn't completely snapped off and you are gritting your teeth and you are squeezing it hard and you can get a drop out. So that's the low transmissivity point. And the absolute residual is when you can get nothing out no matter how hard you try. In theory, then, when you get to a transmissivity of zero, then you can get zero NAPL out of the ground. And relative to that, the range that has become common now is 0.1 to 0.8 square foot per day. And, on slide 83, quick knowledge check before we move on. So you've got a site that we discussed earlier. You've got 7 feet of NAPL in a well. You've had this rain, and now your thickness goes to 9 feet. Can even say it goes to 12 feet, whatever helps you. And you are trying to make a decision whether you have to recover LNAPL or not. Which option would you... So, yeah, so I'll just go by what's coming through. About we've got 70, 80 responses. Most people are saying it's NAPL. You just bail it out and how fast it recovers. That makes sense. That's the right answer. Some people say that LNAPL is confined and does not need to be recovered. You can have NAPL that's confined. It could be still recoverable. If it's, think about NAPL sitting in a gravel and it's confined with some sort of a finer layer, but your mobile NAPL interval is all in gravel, so you could still have some recoverable NAPL. So that's why it makes sense to actually do a recovery test. And basically what you see, what you've picked in C is a qualitative description of transmissivity, right? So there's no numbers on it, but that's what you do in a transmissivity test. You bail it out and see how fast it comes. Or you pump and see how much you can recover and you do some math, which you'll see in the streaming too, to put some numbers around it, but that's the concept. And with that, I'll hand over to Natasha for the next section.
Thanks, Sanjay. In this section, we'll talk about key message 8, and this is really related to Sheens. It's a relatively short section, but if anyone has questions, we'd certainly be happy to follow up on them. So important to understand, there's a number of different reasons why you might be seeing sheening, and they're not necessarily associated with NAPL migration. So what do these sheens look like? We have petroleum sheens that follow this typical rainbow image that you see here on slide 85, and they can be originating from NAPL and the sediments at the groundwater surface water interface. It's also important to be aware that not all sheens are necessarily hydrocarbon related. There can also be sheens associated with natural organics, so that's something to consider when you're looking at any sheening at your site. The hydrocarbon sheens will tend to have more of an oily composition. So if you stir them with a stick, they'll reform in a sort of a seamless manner. If it's an organic sheen, they'll tend to fracture. So it's something to be aware of, not necessarily hydrocarbon. But if it is hydrocarbon, there are a few different release mechanisms that we can consider. So the first release mechanism that we see here on slide 86 is a seep. In this case, we have NAPL on the water table that's migrating towards a water body, and that's a groundwater discharge then that's causing the NAPL to migrate into the water body and cause a NAPL sheen. The second sheen release mechanism is ebullition. In this case, we have some sort of NAPL that's degrading below our surface water body. As part of that degradation, the microbes are producing carbon dioxide and methane, and those gases then migrate to the surface, and they can carry a little bit of NAPL along with them. So that thin film of NAPL that's around the gas bubble as it migrates to the surface and bursts on the water surface can generate a sheen. And this really also points to the fact that you don't need very much NAPL to sheen. It's just really a very small amount can cause that sheening to be observed. Our third release mechanism is erosion. So on the top of this slide, slide 88, you can see there's bank erosion that's potentially exposing some NAPL, and then that can cause the NAPL to be in contact with that surface water body and lead to a sheen. So a key point here is that transport of NAPL to surface water is not necessarily gradient driven. There can be a number of different reasons why you're seeing this NAPL appear at the water surface and potentially cause sheening issues. So a very short section, but please, if you have questions, do reach out to us. And I'll hand it back to Sanjay for Key Message 9.
All right. Thanks, Natasha. Almost for the home stretch now. So I'll talk about some biological processes. And if you've been in the industry for any period of time, the monitored natural attenuation concept's been there for some time now. And we all kind of recognize that hydrocarbons that dissolve, they deplete, and the traditional conceptual model was hydrocarbons go into the water, they dissolve like BTEX, and there are these microbes that chew them up, and you can estimate how much is getting chewed up based on these electron acceptor changes, concentration changes, dissolved oxygen, nitrate, sulfate, et cetera, et cetera. And if you do that estimate based on some reasonable ground of velocity, the typical concentrations, et cetera, of these electron acceptors, it accounts for about 50 gallons per acre per year depletion of hydrocarbons by that mechanism. And so this was 1990s, this bioscreen, I'm on slide 90, I was on slide 90, I'm on slide 91. So that bioscreen model came up, I think in the 90s sometime, and that's what we were taught in school, at least I was, that was the mechanism how hydrocarbons deplete. Then in the more recent times, in the last 10 or so years, started a little bit earlier, but in the last 10 years, 5-7 years, became more prominent, where a lot of these studies started coming out and started measuring a different indicator of degradation. And basically, all of them concluded that the rates are of the order of a few hundred to few thousand gallons per acre per year. Right, so there was that discrepancy between this old conceptual model where things have to dissolve to degrade versus what was being seen as getting depleted. So going to slide 92, so there was a discrepancy, and there was these series of papers that started coming out where this people started recognizing this another mechanism that's degrading, and it doesn't manifest itself in electron acceptor concentration depletion. If you just account for that, you are you're underestimating a significant mechanism, and that mechanism was methanogenesis in the source zone in the NAPL, near the NAPL area, essentially. So there's these bugs called methanogens. They don't really need chemicals or hydrocarbons to dissolve in water necessarily. There are other mechanisms, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But these methanogens, they deplete this hydrocarbon, and it manifests itself. It kind of, that methane goes up the air, and there's something that happens on the way, which we'll talk about. But methane flux can be measured as a CO2 on the surface. And this paper from 2006 said that this mechanism of diffusion through the radar zone could be two orders of magnitude higher than the groundwater pathway that we normally recognize and kind of accounted for in our site strategies. So this is the kind of a more recent conceptualization. You'll see a lot of publications, a lot of guidance documents coming out, including one from ITRC, the LNAPL group. And very simply, the conceptual model is that you've got this NAPL body, and yeah, in this case, we don't have the nice picture that you had before, but the red is the NAPL body, some of it submerged, and these methanogens, they kind of degrade there by that equation that's to your right, and what comes out is the CO2 and methane as part of your biodegradation reaction. Maybe if you have some lighter NAPL components, they can volatilize. That shows up as VOCs, so the green arrow. And so these gases, the methane, the CO2, the hydrocarbons like benzene, they are traveling up vertically. And from the surface, you've got oxygen coming down, diffusing down. And you have this zone in the middle that's kind of got that orange star where these gases, the CO2, the methane and VOC especially, they meet this oxygen. And there's another group of bacteria that likes to eat methane, and it converts to CO2. And what you measure, and all of these methods, the ones that I did, not the methods, but the results that I showed on that earlier slide, which showed hundreds to thousands of gallons per acre per year, they all kind of measure the CO2 signal in some form or the other to come up with that rate. So this mechanism is important, and that's where you get 10 times to 100 times more than what's dissolving through your saturated zone. Slide 94, just a little bit more detail on that. The picture on the left kind of describes, there's a really good paper, if somebody's interested in the detail, but it describes that bugs will find, in a very simple term, bugs will find food. If it's not dissolved, it's a different kind of bacteria, but it'll find food, it'll go directly to the oil. It'll attach to the oil, it'll form an emulsion near the oil or kind of solubilize the oil, somehow it'll find oil. And in the picture at the bottom, the photograph, it basically just shows a bacteria with some octadecane. Octadecane is a chemical that's part of these hydrocarbons, has essentially zero solubility for practical purposes, but bugs find it, it chews it. And on the right-hand side is a graph, or chromatogram. Over two periods of time, the one with the pink circles are alkanes, straight chain alkanes. The one with the blue circles are things that don't degrade, isoprenoids. And basically what it's showing is some of these longer chain alkanes that traditional belief was that if they don't dissolve, so bacteria can't eat them, they're depleted. They're depleted faster than short chain alkanes. So even things that don't dissolve eventually get consumed by bacteria. So that has become a different, kind of helps us now with the conceptualization why NAPL over time just goes away even if it's not soluble, why some of these alkanes go away, so it kind of explains all of that. And last slide again, just to tie things together, Natasha showed this slide, that NAPL is present from the time that it exceeds at CSAT, at least at the theoretical level it's present, and you have this residual NAPL when it cannot flow, or at a level where it accumulates in a well, or could be even moving, that's mobile or migrating. Throughout that entire segment, the entire range, you can have NAPL composition concern. Your benzene concerns are the same in the orange zone and in the red zone. Whereas if you have NAPL moving from one point to another, like in a new release, then you're probably on the right-hand side of that red section. And if you have NAPL just accumulating in the well, you are in that red section somewhere. And when you are at that NAPL transmissivity of 0.1 to 0.8 square foot per day, you have just crossed that orange and you are in that very left side of that red. And that's where most of your saturation concerns should have been addressed at that low transmissivity, but you have some NAPL that's still potentially flowable. With that, I think I will hand back to Randy.
Yeah. Close out. Okay. Yes. Thanks, right. Andre. Thanks, Natasha. I would love to say that I can change the slide, but my computer just blinked. So, Tad Beer, if you could do this for me. I only have two slides here. Basically, folks, you learned a lot today, and I can still see from the participant numbers. Most of you have hung on, and we really appreciate that. We know there's a lot of information. There's a lot of detail here that we weren't able to cover. So again, please go back to our ITRC webpage to be able to download this information and use it as you will. But today, that part one is what we covered. All right, connect science to the LMAP. Well, connecting the science and understanding it will help you, do a better job. All of us think you will do a better job if you understand the science. Okay, next week is part two, building your LMAP conceptual site model. Again, a very important component. So what, and then after that, as noted, part three is selecting the actual LMAP strategy and remedy at your site. And then, again, everything goes together to take all of this information and wrap it up so you can effectively manage or make the correct decision for your LNAPL cases. Now, for the homework for next week, what I'd like you to do, like all of us would like you to do, is think about the cases you have right now. Think about those ones that are just sitting on the back burner or you're not quite sure what you are going to do with them. Is there anything you learned today that's going to help you rethink those, to reevaluate those, to give you a new perspective as to what to do with them? And again, both for the regulators who are involved and the consultants who are involved and the citizens who are involved and stakeholders and everybody needs to come together to understand what we're talking about and to develop the best approach to deal with your site. So everybody here can get value from this. So take the sites that you have, take the information, and think about them. So when next week when we're talking about the conceptual site model, you'll be able to maybe, you know, in the back of your mind, thinking about the ones that you actually have. So I'm going to now turn over to Tad Beer to wrap things up. But again, thank you very much for attending today, and we hope that you're here next week. So Tad Beer, wrap it up.
Thanks, Randy. At this time, we will have another Q&A period. Remember, you can type your questions in the Q&A pod at the bottom right corner of your screen. Before we go to questions, I'm going to pull up a couple polls for you to fill out. Also, the Clue-In training page will remain active in case you'd like to access it at a later time. We would like to hear back from you today, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that's linked to on the last slide. You can also access the feedback form by clicking Feedback in the related link section and then clicking Browse too. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion. And with that, we'll move on to a few questions. Remember, it is #6 to unmute if you are on the phone line and would like to ask a question. Okay, I have some questions on the Adobe Connect software. What are the variables that affect how much microbes will be active in degrading hydrocarbons?
I can start that. So the microbes, kind of like people, want to be, you know, generally happy in their environment. So first you need a degradable hydrocarbon. So if you have a very heavy hydrocarbon or a heavily weathered hydrocarbon, that's going to be more challenging for the bugs to be active. If you have a lighter crude oil or a refined product, they're probably going to be a little more active. They're going to want a nice environment to live in, so they want to have enough moisture, and depending on the bug, enough of the appropriate electronic receptor, so let's use oxygen, for example, they're going to want to have enough nutrients. So in some cases, if you think about like a land farming environment, you can have nutrient limitation. It's similar in the natural environment. You could potentially have a nutrient limitation. And then also looking at temperature, if you think about biodegradation in cold climates, maybe somewhere like Alaska, that's going to be really slow. The bugs are not so happy. If you think about degradation in warmer climates, somewhere maybe closer to the tropics, the bugs are going to be relatively active and be degrading that hydrocarbon a little bit more quickly.
Thanks, Natasha. Is there a test method for residual saturation?
Yeah, so the test method that we looked at, I'll forget the slide here, but we have the Dean-Stark extraction. So there's a centrifuge test that you can do that's typically done in more specialized laboratories, geologic laboratories, but it is a standard test. And what they do in that case is they centrifuge at different levels, different pressures, the soil sample, so it's like a small plug of a soil sample that you could collect from your material, and they'll centrifuge that out, so looking at different pressures at which NAPA will be removed from that sample, and then you can relate those pressures, or you should be looking at the pressures that will be related to pressures that you would expect in the environment. So you're sort of simulating whether or not you'll have NAPA moving under different pressures, and the key is that they will be pressures that will be representative of what they'll experience in the environment. One thing to be aware of with those tests is that they're developed largely for exploration, so the pressures might be a little bit higher, so you do need to constrain those to environmentally relevant pressures.
And to just add to that, some labs do this newer method, which is more representative, it's more expensive, it's called a water drive. So in the centrifuge method that Natasha described, basically there's air that's displacing as the centrifuge is moving, the air is displacing the oil and the fluids in the core, whereas in reality when you are in the saturated zone, it's basically all a saturated system. So this water drive actually is a column where you are essentially pushing water through there. That's more representative of environmental conditions. As a practice, just from personal practice, about 10 years back, any site that we had, any big site that we had NAPA issues at, we would send it for centrifuge test and water drive test. And over the years, as our conceptual understanding improved and kind of we started seeing that it's really not coming into the strategy development for the site, it's not helping with practical decision making, we kind of started moving more towards transmissivity testing as more of a practical indicator of relative permeability versus the conceptual and the lab measurement. In a strict sense, you can that's the test where you get quote-unquote the defined residual saturation measurement is through a centrifuge test.
All right, our time is winding down for today. So thank you for your questions, and thank you to our trainers for providing answers. If you need further clarifications on answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered, or you're welcome to follow up with our trainers directly. Thank you to our trainers for participating and answering those questions and being fantastic today. And also special thanks to our participants. We appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us today. And remember, we do archive our classes, so if you were unable to join the whole time, you're welcome to access our archives. As Randy mentioned, the LNAPL Training Part 2 will be held on January 16th from 1 to 3:15 Eastern. And with that, that concludes our training for today, and we hope you will join us again.